This is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of January. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier. Here's what we got for you this week. Why Uber and Lyft supporters delivered 65,000 signatures to the Austin City Clerk this week.
We do not operate in any city that requires a mandatory fingerprint for our peer-to-peer platform.
Open carry of handguns is legal in Texas, but how many guns can one person carry?
Most folks open carry one pistol, and we do not open carry five or six guns.
But it's technically legal.
It is exactly legal.
And a review of an Indian restaurant that is our regular critic's new favorite.
It's not just Indian food. You get some of those Nepalese influences on the menu as well.
Those stories and much more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, a reminder to subscribe to this podcast. Weekend.KUT.org is the place to go to find links to our iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and RSS feeds. Please leave us a review in the Apple Podcasts app or in the iTunes store if you haven't already. I see many people have. Thank you so much if you did that. It's amazing. And if you have any questions or comments, email news@KUT.org. My email is nathan@KUT.org. You can always follow me on Twitter if you want to. I'm @KUTNathan. So the daily fantasy sports site DraftKings says it will continue to operate in Texas despite a non-binding legal opinion this week from Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. This opinion said those sites are violating state law. Paxton released an opinion saying Texas law only requires partial chance for something to be gambling. And he says the fact that a third party is taking a cut of the deal also makes it illegal. Now, an attorney for several smaller daily fantasy sports sites, Kevin Vela, says this law exempts bets made over the determination of skill.
You just have to have the right client who's willing to be the one who proves that. And, you know, I don't represent DraftKings or FanDuel, and those guys have significantly larger war chests to fight these sort of things.
Paxton went on ESPN Radio in Dallas. As you can imagine, the hosts were not really thrilled with the idea that daily fantasy sports was illegal. But Paxton reassured them that he's not shutting anything down.
We don't even have the ability as the Attorney General's office to pursue criminal action. That would be local district attorneys. So all we're doing is issuing an opinion based on the law. We haven't taken any action at all.
But Kevin Vela, that attorney, says he might advise his clients to close up shop just to avoid any legal risk. As we record this podcast on a Friday, there are just 9 days left until the Iowa caucuses. 9 days until that first shot that will set the stage for the rest of the presidential nominating process. The U.S. Senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, is still within striking distance of the juggernaut that is Donald Trump. The latest averaging of Iowa polls of Republicans from Real Clear Politics has Trump with 29% support in Iowa and Cruz with 26.4%. So that's a spread of just 2.6 percentage points, which is smaller than the margin of error in some of these polls. Now, we are heading into the second to last weekend of campaigning. This will be a critical time for Cruz to try and close that gap and slingshot himself into the March primaries. That includes many southern states in the great state of Texas. That is pivotal to his campaign strategy. This week, Sarah Palin endorsed Donald Trump. On Saturday, radio host Glenn Beck is set to endorse Ted Cruz. But Cruz may still have to answer some questions about a series of loans he took out to fund his 2012 Senate campaign. An Austin group that monitors campaign finance wants the Federal Election Commission to take action over Cruz's failure to report the loans, and these loans totaled about $1 million. KUT's Matt Largy has that story.
The New York Times first uncovered that Cruz did not report the loans from Goldman Sachs and Citibank in his campaign reports in 2012. The loans were taken out against his personal assets. Cruz then loaned the money to his campaign. Now, Texans for Public Justice, a group that tracks money in political campaigns, wants the Federal Election Commission to investigate. In a letter Tuesday, the group's Craig McDonald argues Cruz violated federal law by not promptly disclosing the loans. Cruz has said it was an oversight and that the loans were disclosed in statements filed with the Senate. McDonald took issue with that.
Those statements came 12 months after his first loan that he did not report. They also came well after he was elected to the Senate. So the election was over. So the public had no chance to really peruse where his actual campaign money was coming from.
The FEC could issue a fine if it finds any violations. Emails to the Cruz campaign for comment on the request were not returned. Matt Largy, KUT News.
The presidential race will top a lot of news coverage for the next 10 months, but that is not stopping Texas Governor Greg Abbott from trying to work his way into the spotlight. KUT's Ben Philpott reports on what the governor's goals might be in his recent efforts to gain national attention.
This week, Governor Abbott's trip to Israel and Switzerland have topped the headlines in Texas. Earlier this month, it was a call to give individual states more power by amending the U.S. Constitution that gave him a national platform. Here he is on Fox News talking about his proposed amendments, including one that would allow states to override decisions from the U.S. Supreme Court.
The Constitution is amended every single year by just five people who wear robes on the United States Supreme Court.
But considering the GOP's electoral strength in Texas and the governor's overwhelming election victory in 2014, why has Abbott pushed so hard to stay on the front page?
Well, I mean, I think in a lot of ways he's behaving like you would expect from a Republican governor in the state of Texas circa 2015, 2016.
Darren Shaw is a government professor and pollster at UT Austin. He says attacking the federal government and lobbying for states' rights poll very high among Republican voters and makes attacking President Obama's executive actions easy picking.
The Constitution was written to protect against those types of dictates. The problem is these departures from the Constitution are not the aberration. Now they have become the norm.
So, Shaw says, calling for a constitutional convention aimed squarely at the feds can't hurt Abbott in Texas.
You don't have a ton of power. There's no ledge session this time around. So what do you do to maintain your relevance in a year that's going to be dominated by the presidential primary and then later on by the presidential election?
The move also helps shield Abbott from any GOP challengers who may be trying to move to the right of Abbott for the 2018 gubernatorial race. Ben Philpott, KUT News.
Thanks, Ben. By the way, Ben Philpott will be traveling to Iowa on Sunday to follow Cruz for the days leading up to the Iowa caucus. People trying to stop new regulation of ride-hailing apps Uber and Lyft delivered 65,000 signatures to the city clerk this week. Aubrey Hayes drives for Lyft. She was among those who helped collect those signatures, and she says she's concerned new rules proposed by the Austin City Council would drive Uber and Lyft out of town.
There's so many people I can name from so many different walks of life that use the service that wouldn't be able to, like, you know, even get to their jobs, like, if they didn't have this.
Once the city clerk validates 20,000 of those signatures, the city council would have 10 days to vote on the ordinance put forward by Uber and Lyft. If the city council declines to approve it, that ordinance would be put to a public vote. Basically, this ordinance would enshrine the rules that the city adopted in 2014 with a few changes. So what's behind all this? Why are Uber and Lyft fighting so hard against new proposed regulations? KUT's Audrey McGlinchey followed some petition collectors to find out.
Lyft drivers Mo Rattel and Monique Mitchell are spending a Wednesday afternoon in Zilker Park. They've got clipboards and pens, plus a reporter at their heels.
Hey, how's it going?
How are you?
Good. Hey, we've got a petition here to try to keep ride sharing in Austin.
To keep what is it?
Ride sharing, like Uber and Lyft.
Oh, cool, yeah.
Are you a registered Austin voter?
I am, maybe. I might, wait. When did I last vote?
You're still registered if you voted. If
yeah.
you've been an Austin registered
yeah, yeah,
voter,
yeah.
you
I
should be still
I
registered.
I think I registered like 2 years ago.
Okay, that'll work.
Cool.
So you just print here and sign there, fill out the rest, and just put your date of birth so we can get you.
The woman willingly signs, and Rattel and Mitchell move on to the next. Of the four people they approach, two sign, one says they signed another petition, and another says no.
The main thing here is we're not trying to get people to decide how they feel about the issue, just to get it on the ballot. And honestly, I tried to steer away from talking about the
politics.
Yeah,
specifics,
because it's not about that, you know.
Well, actually, it is about specifics. one specific.
Fingerprints.
For drivers. The Austin City Council has said in some form or another, it wants to require Uber and Lyft drivers to pass fingerprint-based background checks. Both Uber and Lyft already do background checks, just not fingerprint ones. And if required to do so, both Uber and Lyft have said they will leave Austin. Now, Uber has not pulled out of Houston, a city that does require fingerprints. But the company says it's not the ideal situation for their business model, and they won't do it in Austin. Lyft has never been okay with fingerprint-based background checks. Here's Lyft representative April Mims at a council meeting in December.
In case it's unclear, we do not operate in any city that requires a mandatory fingerprint for our peer-to-peer platform.
So what's the big deal? Let's get a little back and forth going. Actually, that seems more appropriate. First, the companies say fingerprint-based background checks are too burdensome for drivers that are primarily part-time. And they say their business model depends on it being easy to join, ensuring a large and flexible group of drivers. Here's Uber representative Adam Blinnick testifying in front of the Council Mobility Committee in October.
50% of our drivers are on the platform for less than 10 hours a week. So the more steps and the more costs and the more hoops you make someone jump through, the less chance they're going to take advantage of this economic opportunity and even test it.
One of the things that needs to be easy is, you know, where and when and how someone can get fingerprinted.
City Councilmember Ann Kitchen says, fine, the city will help make it easy to do fingerprints.
Well, we have an approach where we can work with a company through the FBI that will make arrangements to come to an individual to do the fingerprints. And we have a range of options, coming to the individual, setting up convenient times and places for the individual to come to be fingerprinted.
But Uber and Lyft also argue making it easier isn't enough. The ride-hailing companies say fingerprint-based background checks can lead to incomplete information. Fingerprints are run through an FBI database, and the federal agency relies on local jurisdictions to report how arrests are concluded. Some groups argue slow reporting can mean only an arrest, and not whether someone is convicted or acquitted of a crime shows up on a background check. But Kitchen says using fingerprints can ensure accuracy at the get-go, making sure potential drivers are who they say they are.
Because if you're just getting information on a piece of paper and you go and check that person based on their social security number or other pieces of information, you don't know if you're really checking the person that's going to be driving. The fingerprints are the identifier of the individual.
But perhaps the argument heard most frequently from Uber and Lyft is one time-tested maxim, said here by Uber's Blinnick.
Please don't fix what is not broken.
The companies say the background checks we run work well. Uber says not only do they run national searches, but the company will send someone in person to local courthouses where a potential driver has lived to make sure there's nothing on the books. Lyft says they use an applicant's social security number to compile a past list of addresses and check those local jurisdictions. That's all well and good, says Kitchen, but the city's just trying to do everything it can to ensure its public is safe.
The city council does not want Uber or Lyft to leave. That's never been what this is about. This is about our responsibility to the public to put in pretty basic, simple public safety requirements. And I'd be sorry to see them go, but to threaten the city for safety requirements is really irresponsible. They're abandoning their drivers. The drivers aren't going anywhere.
This week, Mayor Steve Adler proposed an incentives plan to reward drivers who voluntarily get a fingerprint-based background check. It's a compromise he hopes will help bring the two sides together before the council votes on January 28th. Audra McGlinchey, KUT News.
Michael Dell, founder of Dell, one of the richest people in Texas, over the past 4 years has been spending millions of dollars, about $80 million, buying small TV stations across the country, small over-the-air TV stations. Some hedge funds have been doing that too. And now Michael Dell, because of this, stands to make a tremendous amount of money. Joining us to explain why is Mark Dewey. He's a reporter who covers business and technology. Mark, good to see you.
Glad to be here, Nathan.
Why is Michael Dell
buying small TV stations all over the country.
It's fascinating. He's been doing this for almost 5 years, hiding in plain sight. The broadcast media press have been writing about it for years, asking that same question. Why is he buying up these small stations, paying what all the insiders thought was too much for stations? Like one of them ran church programming and Roseanne reruns.
Right. So these are obscure.
These are independent stations. Okay. Yes, obscure stations, not your basic broadcast stations associated with the broadcast networks. But what he knew, and some other people knew that other people didn't, was that when the government bought some of the spectrum back at auction, that the government was going to pay some big bucks. And there was a lot more money there than anyone thought.
Okay, so what's the purpose of buying these TV stations, the technical purpose? You're saying it has to do with smartphones, right?
It all goes back to smartphones, yes. Our smartphones, which about 7 out of 10 of us have now, according to the government, these smartphones are hungry for more and more broadcast spectrum because we have to transmit, you know, videos, audio, data, and companies like Verizon and AT&T and other companies even like Google and Dish Network are saying more, more, more. We need more wireless broadcast spectrum. So what the government is doing, the FCC, is they're going to take some spectrum from broadcast TV stations and they're going to give it, or actually sell it, auction it off to the wireless companies. So everybody knew this was going to happen. The FCC's done almost 100 auctions in its history, but no one really had a sense of the scale of this one. No one but Michael Dell and two other big investment firms that were buying these stations. People thought they were crazy and they were coming in and paying too much, but they obviously had a good view of what the end game was going
to
be.
How are they able to get that view? Did they have insider information or were they just geniuses?
Probably more on the genius end. No one would comment for this story, as you might expect, but some people told me on background that there are consulting firms and hedge funds that have set up enormously complex models of this auction process about what was going to happen. So they hired economists, auction experts, computer programmers, engineers, and they built these huge and detailed models of the auction process so that they could simulate buying back spectrum from TV stations and then selling it to the wireless companies. And some big dollar companies like Dell's investment fund certainly would have had the resources to tap into one of these models, or maybe they would have even built their own.
Wow.
To really get an idea that the values were going to be higher than people thought.
And we're talking how much money?
Dell spent somewhere near $80 million to put together his group of a dozen or so stations. The bids start on those stations at $4 billion. Insiders think they'll ultimately sell for about $1 billion. It's a reverse auction, so the numbers go down, which is very confusing. So his $80 million or so could easily turn into $1 billion.
That's a pretty good return on investment.
It's a great return on investment, certainly.
I'm confused about this auction process, and I don't want to get too into the weeds, but the FCC buys the stations from Michael Dell and then sells them to AT&T, Verizon, and so on?
They're not actually buying the stations. They're just buying the spectrum that the stations use.
Okay.
So actually, every TV station in America was given a number. And that was a number associated with, if you'll relinquish your broadcast spectrum and just give it back to the government, here's your number. So all the stations have gotten that number, and most stations aren't going to consider selling back their spectrum. But there are some other alternatives. They can share channels with somebody else, or they can move channels. But basically, it's these independent stations that are having a rough go of it now because they're competing with the internet and satellite and everything else. So they're having trouble making it economically, and selling it back to the government looks like a great deal, and obviously it is.
When is this going to all go down?
Well, it's already started. It's a long process, and it really runs until spring.
I imagine some of these stations are in Texas.
None of the stations that Michael Dell has bought or that we know that he's purchased are in Texas. But all the Texas stations have been given offers to give back their spectrum. The highest number was $353 million for KTVT, the CBS station in Dallas-Fort Worth.
That's the offer from the FCC?
From the FCC, yeah. Now, that number would go down through the auction process and would end up lower. Although insiders tell me that no CBS or major network station would consider doing that. So that's not really on the table. But if you go down to some of the smaller markets like Victoria, Texas, has two stations and their offers have totaled $100 million. So it's really all over the place.
Is this going to mean fewer over-the-air stations in these markets or no? You said they can share channels maybe.
They can share channels and they can go through the internet. So there will be fewer broadcasters, but not that anyone would notice.
Okay. Mark Dewey is a reporter who covers business and technology. Really interesting story, Mark. I appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot.
The Texas Open Carry Law that's been in effect since the start of the year, it combines the state's pre-existing concealed carry licensing regime with open carry to create a single permit that you need to carry a handgun in Texas. More than 400 businesses have banned open carry in their premises, according to a running tally by the gun control group Moms Demand Action. And people opposed to it fear that it could make Texas sidewalks look like an Old West movie. So that got KUT's Andrew Weber wondering, you know, just how many guns could a permit holder openly carry?
The short answer, as I suspected, is a lot. But before we get to the armory, let's talk enforcement. So far, the Austin Police Department has received only one call about somebody openly carrying, according to Commander Andy Michaels. It's less than the department anticipated, and Michaels says he hasn't personally seen anyone openly carrying yet, let alone anyone carrying multiple weapons.
There's nothing in the law that prohibits that. I think if you saw that, it would be more likely somebody at a demonstration or something like that, you know. But I don't think your day-to-day citizen or your license holder is going to carry multiple guns. But if they do, it's well within the law.
To test that, I took a trip to Central Texas Gun Works.
I guarantee you they're going to come up to you and see that gun and ask you to leave.
Michael Cargill owns the shop and teaches license to carry courses to would-be carriers. He took a break from a class to load me up with pistols. While the law doesn't limit the number of guns a license holder can carry, it does limit the kind of holsters that house them: shoulder holsters and belt holsters. We start with the belt.
Ready?
There's one, two, three, four, five, and finally.
So, six?
You have, I don't even know, I lost track.
It's six.
Is it six?
Okay. Yeah, I was there for it.
All right. How's that feel?
How do you...
Can you do a hula hoop?
No, not really. I feel like my pants are about to fall down.
None of the pistols are loaded. I repeat, none of them are loaded. So, taking into account a shoulder holster that would hold two pistols conceivably, I could carry eight pistols openly. Obviously, this is not the norm.
Most folks open carry one pistol, and we do not open carry five or six guns.
Okay.
It's not logical. It's just not the way to go. And, you know, we don't want to look ridiculous.
But it's technically legal.
It's legal. It is exactly legal.
That's not taking into account how many guns one could concealed carry. While the law allows officers to request to see any carrier's license, APD's Andy Michaels says their officers aren't trained to immediately ask a person who's openly carrying for a license. But an officer would if they had probable cause or reasonable suspicion.
It would be additional information. Maybe he had taken it out of the holster. Maybe he was involved in a disturbance. Maybe he was inside a business that was posted with the proper signage. Things of that nature may change the call for us.
Andrew Weber, KUT News.
Do you find yourself reading more news and other stuff on your smartphone or your iPad or your Kindle or computer than you did before? I think most people have. In Texas schools, it's no different. Those old hardcover textbooks a lot of us grew up with are being replaced by digital content on screens. But some parents are finding that less tangible digital content is making it harder to find out what their kids are learning. And that, in some cases, makes it harder to help their kids with homework. KUT's Kate McGee has that story.
Cindy Capley sits in front of her open laptop looking at the teacher website for her daughter's social studies class. Her daughter is in middle school in the Leander Independent School District north of Austin. The website is supposed to have all the online resources her daughter uses for class.
Even this doesn't have as much as I would have thought, although they're doing world culture, so let me see.
Capley clicks to a page that lists six units.
There are some subpages, let me see. Oh, they have video notes.
She clicks on the video notes.
And I need permission.
She's locked out.
So I have come across quite a bit. What happens is, as a parent, I don't always have the permissions that the kids have.
There's also a link to the online textbook, but that requires a login too. Under state law, Leander ISD must allow parents to check out hardcover textbooks, which Capley says she did. When Capley and her son tried to use them at home, she says the hard textbooks were completely foreign to him. They don't use them in class.
And there were many times I couldn't find the answer at any of them. I mean, I'm college educated. I've been doing this a long time. I am a teacher or was a teacher. I couldn't find the answer.
Kapolei turns to her son's notes, called an interactive notebook.
The teachers hand out things or quizzes or tests that they've taken, and then they're supposed to glue it into their notebook, and that's supposed to be what they study from.
It looks like some type of textbook you would find in a third world country.
That's Lori Hines, a parent of four. She shows me her daughter's notebook with a handwritten table of contents, taped-in worksheets, and some notes. Leander ISD says the notebooks are an organization strategy, but for parents, sometimes they are the only accessible resource. Kapolei and Hines aren't the only parents struggling to navigate the new ways schools are teaching children. To understand why things have changed in Texas public schools, we need to go back 5 years to the 2011 legislative session.
Committee on Public Education will please come to order.
That's when lawmakers passed Senate Bill 6. The law allowed school districts to choose their own textbooks and instructional materials. It also changed the way school districts pay for those books. In the past, the State Board of Education approved a list of textbooks. School districts chose what they wanted, ordered them, and the state paid the bill. Districts also got $30 per student for technology.
Well, what they did with Senate Bill 6 is they took the money that they were going to give you for textbooks, the money that you were getting for technology allotment, and they merged them.
That's Rosa Ojeda. She's president-elect of the Instructional Materials Coordinators Association of Texas. So the state said, we're going to combine this funding.
And we're going to put this money out there for you to now use, whether it be technology, whether it be professional development, or whether it be textbooks.
In 2015, Leander ISD, which has 36,000 students, got $7.1 million for textbooks and technology. That has to last 2 years. Before the change, Leander received $17.6 million just for textbooks. That also has to last 2 years. During a 2014 Leander School Board meeting, the district's technology director, Scott Monroe, said less money means they had to make changes.
Certainly on the textbook side, there's no way we could use that to purchase all the textbooks we'd been getting before. And so really,
at the same time the state combined textbook and technology funding, it removed the price cap on textbooks. Debbie Ratcliffe is a spokesperson for the Texas Education Agency.
It used to be that we would set the maximum cost that we would pay for any textbook.
But the state found if it set a price limit, the publishers always charged up to the cap. Lawmakers thought remove the price cap, create competition, and lower the price of print and electronic textbooks.
So far, that really hasn't happened. The electronic materials tend to be about the same cost as the print materials.
By taking away that cap, it really stepped on its own toes.
That's Rosa Ojeda again. She says the change means districts had to get creative with the money they had, use all online resources, use just textbooks, or a mix. With all those options, Ojeda says it's no wonder parents are confused. Districts, schools, and even classrooms can now use completely different teaching styles and instructional materials.
So as parents, that's not the way we were taught.
But as classrooms and textbooks change, she says it's a school district's responsibility to educate parents. State Board of Education member Tom Maynard agrees schools need to work with parents.
That doesn't mean that they have to take off of work and drive up to the school to go do it.
That's exactly what Leander ISD father David Pressler had to do for his second grade son after he taught him math the way he had been taught in school.
And the teacher came back and said, no, that's not what we're doing. That's confusing him. So I said, well, help. So I had to go meet with the teacher and learn how to do math, second grade math.
Pressler says there's not enough communication between the school and parents.
They come home with this blank worksheet. There's no instructions. There's no education for the parents about what the child is supposed to do. And the child brings you this sheet and says, I have to solve this problem.
We asked Leander school officials about these concerns. District officials say there will be growing pains as the district shifts to more online resources. If parents can't get what they need from teachers or a teacher website, the district says they should contact a campus administrator. Kate McGee, KUT News.
Austin has a new Indian restaurant with a slightly different spin on what you might usually expect. And here to talk about it is Austin American Statesman restaurant critic Matthew Odom. Hi, Matthew.
Hey there, Nathan.
So you got away from downtown and checked out this place called Saffron. Where is it exactly?
It's on Far West Boulevard over there in Northwest Hills, just west of Mopac.
And it's kind of a Indian fusion. I mean, it's not just Indian food.
It's not just Indian food. One of the co-owners who moved here after, I think, a 15-year restaurant career in New York City is named Teniso Tashi. And he was raised in Northeast India by a Tibetan father and a Nepalese mother. So you get some of those Nepalese influences on the menu as well. And there's actually a dedicated Nepalese section to the menu.
What are the Nepalese influences? What does that look like?
For instance, you might find, I think you're probably familiar with a chicken lollipop, which is a soy marinated chicken winglet. It's a real popular Kathmandu street food. They're fried and they shimmer with that bright red of turmeric and red chili powder. They also have Nepalese momos, which, being a neighbor to China, it's much like a dumpling. And the ones here are really nice, these pinched steam pouches. You can get them with minced vegetables, and they also have one with aromatic ground chicken, and they serve it with a nice creamy sesame seed-based dipping sauce. Really like that. And also, Nepal, you're going to find a lot of similar flavor profiles to India. They're not quite as intense, and they'll change up the cooking a little bit. So, for instance, they have a goat curry there that's slow-cooked with the bone in, so it oozes its marrow into this intoxicating stew that is breathy with cumin and cinnamon and garlic, and you still have some of that gaminess from the meat. So that's another great nod to Nepal as well.
You're making me hungry. What else was on the menu? What else did you like?
You know, I liked a lot there. You know, starting with the appetizers, a buddy of mine from India says he used to get tricked into eating vegetables when he'd go to weddings in Delhi because this gobi manchurian are these kind of lightly fried cauliflower knobs, and they kind of resemble Indo-Chinese fried chicken. And they have red chili in them and a nice little salty lacquer of soy. Really great cauliflower dish. Of course, there's a tandoori chef there, so you're going to have real bright red supple shrimp. We had some nice tender yogurt-marinated lamb chops that has that nice blend of masala spices. And, you know, of course, you can get typical stuff like the ubiquitous chicken tikka masala or lamb rogan josh that you might find other places. But they also have achari chicken. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
It is one of my favorite dishes so far of the year. It's a pickled and spicy chicken dish. So it's tangy and it's spicy. And the way they get that puckering sauce is they use pickled and dry mangoes. They also have fenugreek that gives its nice sweet nutty profile to a dish that also has ginger and garlic and mustard. So it's a great, complex, exciting dish. At the other end of the spectrum from that, you've got a murg shahi korma, which is a chicken dish that it's more comforting than, say, the electric pickled dish. You've got a rich sauce buttressed by pistachios and cashews with just a kiss of sweetness from raisins. And so those are two great dishes. The naan is really good there. You know, I'm really a fan of a lot of the stuff I had there. Now, Tashi, as I said, worked in New York City for a while. So in addition to the Nepalese and the Indian food, you also get some other fusion type dishes. The Brussels sprouts, they call them Bombay Brussels. Of course, Brussels sprouts are everywhere these days. Yeah. And so I wasn't expecting much, but they were really great. It's one of the best dishes I had there. They revitalized kind of the near exhausted dish. Tossing the chaat masala spice veggies in this tangy sauce sweetened with mango and tamarind. So it's a new take on the Brussels sprout.
Real quickly, what's the ambience like and what's the pricing like?
It was built in an old Indian restaurant that didn't have much going for it. I think they put on a new coat of paint, and they've got the stained concrete floors, some nice light fixtures, but it's not huge on ambiance, maybe a little bright in the evening time. They have a buffet at lunchtime, and the dishes are going to run you anywhere between $9 and $13, so not too bad. You can get out of there for less than $20 a person. Great for lunch or dinner. I've been there for both.
Overall, sounds like you're quite a fan of Saffron.
Yeah, I gotta say, it's my favorite Indian restaurant in town.
Saffron, it's on Far West Boulevard. You can read the full review at austin360.com or in Friday's print edition of the Austin American Statesman. Matthew Odom is the restaurant critic. Thanks for your time, Matthew.
Always a pleasure, Nathan. We'll be right back.
That, my friends, is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of January. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Send any questions or comments you might have to news@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. Thank you.